Well, I've got us recording right now, and if you guys are okay with it, I'm going to dive into some material, and I'd like it to be a combination of presenting some material and dialoguing. Does that sound okay?
Sure.
All right.
Wonderful. Yeah.
All right. One of the things that we've talked about in the last few weeks has been guys wanting to emphasize the actual experience of addiction. And what he wants to bring to integral recovery is a phenomenological perspective, that is an experiential perspective that kind of grounds the four quadrants. And I'm hoping that Guy will give feedback on today, because my wish today with you guys is that we could talk into the actual experience in and around addiction and recovery, and do it from a kind of an upper right quadrant scientific perspective. And so that sounds more boring than I hope it is. So anyway, I'm going to dive in. So we're actually talking about the experience of shame and stigma that so oftentimes gets in the way of people getting treatment for addiction, and going to look at how it is that more information specifically about addiction in the brain might be helpful in overcoming some of the shame and stigma that prevents people from getting help. Now, does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
You guys will have done a fair bit of reading both for this program but also previously, and so I'm not assuming that I'm presenting new information. I will kind of summarize some of the information I've looked at, and also I'm going to remember to send out a bibliography of books and articles that I found helpful in the last year or so. Many of them specifically around the neuroscience of addiction, for whatever interest you might have. So I'll be sending that out, but I'm assuming that many of you have read as much or more than I have. So we'll lay down some foundations, but we'll talk into that together. I guess, first of all, I want to bring together these two areas, shame and stigma on the one hand, and contributions from neuroscience on the other hand. But in order to even set that in terms of its importance, I want to talk about a few statistics, that some of which we've read about already in the Califano book, and some of these you might not be aware of, but I'm just going to run them by us and see if these resonate for you guys. The first one is a statistic I read from from SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration out of Washington, D.C., that this is a shockaroo for people like me that have done therapy for years and years, is that up to one out of two clients that come in to see any of us in any form of coaching, counseling, or therapy are addicted to substance. That statistic varies, but it's up to one out of two are currently addicted. That is, people coming into therapy, I guess I should say this, most people coming into therapy don't come in saying I'm addicted and that's why I'm here. Most of them come in saying I've got marriage problems, or I've got work problems, I've got family problems, whatever. And what comes to light over time is that so many of them who came in for another so-called co-occurring disorder are also presenting with a substance abuse disorder. I'm just curious, does that match your guys' sense of things? Does that surprise you? Is that already familiar to you? It was a surprise to me.
It's a surprise to me, too, that most people that are going into therapy for an issue don't even know that the underlying issue, one out of two, are that issue
started to respond to that statistic and it got cut off.
No, I was agreeing with what you said, that I find it surprising that half of the people going into therapy for an issue are not aware that the underlying root of the issue is a substance abuse problem.
Yes, that's it does, I have to tell you, it does match my experience over the years when I go in hindsight. And Eddie and Derek, something that Hamlet and I were talking about right before we met is that for whatever reason, Hamlet wasn't aware, and I take responsibility for this, that I join you guys in terms of being in recovery. And what I want to say is two things. If I haven't made that clear, let me make that clear, is that I'm in recovery myself from both alcohol and prescription drugs, and take this stuff way beyond just theoretically. It's way personal for me. So let me be clear about that. And then secondly, to say in light of this statistic is that I went into therapy without an awareness that addiction was such a important. It was the foundation of everything, and I'm like exhibit A of this very point. Is I was one of the clients that went into therapy, was dealing with whatever issues I was dealing with, and never got down to this level, and more was my loss as a result of that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Different way or the other direction in that it's relatively low. I believe that 80 to 90% are of people on this earth are addicted in some form or fashion to looking away from their life and the reality through some kind of substance or behavior. And it's interesting to me. I these topics are pretty cool, or they're cool. My passion is helping people get to the point of seeing that difference. Like one second, you know, Bob, you were doing your deal, and I was doing my deal, and Hamlet was doing his deal, and Derek of our lives of using and, you know, anesthetizing ourselves or whatever your term is, addicted, habit, affliction. And then the next second, like bing, you know, we decide, or, you know, it's a process sometimes, and sometimes it's immediate, that window of opportunity to see reality of how we've been living. So I think that doesn't surprise me, except that the numbers as low as it is. People, I was in a fog. I'm sure I'm still in a fog. There's a lot of things I don't see, but I was sure in a deeper fog in my life, just like living it, but yet somewhat like a zombie or anesthetizing myself, changing my mood and mind through chemicals and behaviors. And
Yes.
sadly or realistically, again, I don't, I might be off my rocker. All right, and Guy, to catch you up, we were speaking about that Califani or pronunciation, saying that in his book that over 50% of the people that come into therapy or depression or et cetera, and we talked about how that's a relatively high number, maybe surprising, and I agree, yet I think the number, I might be projecting, but I think 80 to 90% of the planet is addicted to changing their mind or mood or looking away through substance or behaviors that are not productive in their life.
Yeah. You'll see that statistic that I just posted, Eddie, that another recent statistic I came across, I think it was the National Institute for Drug Abuse, that 90% of the US population is addicted to a non-drug or behavioral, at least one across a lifetime. That may be low too, but as soon as you open it up to non-drug or non-substance addictions, it's well nigh universal. And so that gets the power of that statistic. And that'd be more in sync with what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like a coping strategy, or, you know, that Tommy Rosen on that Recovery 2.0 that John was on, he said, hey, you know, he's run the gamut in behaviors and addictions and recovery now. He says, I was addicted to looking away. And he just would go from one to another. And I can identify and relate to that.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying. Is Guy, we started with a statistic from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration that's come out recently, is that up to one half of clients coming into coaching, therapy, counseling, although they don't present with it explicitly, are addicted to alcohol and other drugs. And so it gets your attention in a hurry in terms of the prevalence of so-called co-occurring disorders coming in to see any therapist. One of the ironies, you guys, is that right up until the present time, most therapists, as well as most physicians, have very little education in substance abuse treatment, including diagnosis. Recently talked to a physician who's now an addictionologist, board-certified addictionologist. He had one lecture in graduate school on addiction, and he's medical school, and he's getting out of medical school and prescribing opiates, you know, that, and he says that's not that atypical still in medical school. So, in light of the prevalence, it's ironic and beyond ironic, painful to look at the lack of attention that's given in our education typically to the service providers. Let me share just a few more statistics, if I may, with you guys. You've read Califano, who says that in his study at Columbia University, that 80% of imprisoned individuals are there because of drugs. They were either high while committing the offense, or selling drugs, or procuring drugs, and that's 80%. And that, and I just shared this statistic recently with somebody who worked in the prison system, and they said they believe that's a also a low estimate. So, just in the last few weeks, I've read the Center for Disease Control out of Atlanta, and that. That we had three times more drug overdose deaths this last year than just 10 years previous across the nation. And it's referred to by the Center for Disease Control as a, if not international, at least national epidemic. It classifies as an epidemic when you have that many deaths owing to a phenomenon like drug overdose. A couple more statistics that right now, 1 out of 10 adults, and that's classified as anybody over the age of 12 in the U.S., 1 out of 10 adults is currently addicted to alcohol or another drug. And then to add a sobering piece to that, only 10% of those addicted ever receive treatment. So you've got 1 out of 10 people that are addicted. And out of that addicted population, only 1 out of 10 of that addicted population ever receive treatment, which means 90% go untreated.
And then that 10% that receives treatment has still got a low success rate as well on top of it.
It was interesting that you'd mention that, Guy. The National Institute for Drug Abuse just released a meta-analysis. And what that is, y'all, is just a, it's a study of all the studies that you can do statistical analyses of every study that itself was a statistical analysis. In a recent meta-analysis, the conclusion was that treatment is effective, but it depends on how you define treatment, doesn't it, Guy? Is that treatment means prolonged maintenance treatment across time. In other words, there's one way of looking at it is that treatment never really stops. And if you provide extended treatment, that is, if you can get a client to be in kind of full-body treatment across time, it is effective at addressing addiction. But that doesn't exclude relapse any more than you would exclude relapse with other chronic illnesses. And so this was their conclusion. I'm interested in reading more detail about it. That's the good news, if there's any good news in it. The bad news is that without treatment, and most people go untreated, they really either end up going to prison, that previous statistic, 80% of those imprisoned, or they die way too young. And that's the overdose statistic, is that it's killing people, especially younger youth and young adults, in epidemic numbers. And so it's all very, for lack of a better word, it's all very sobering in terms of looking at what's going on. One of the things I've been reading about a lot in the last year or two are trying to look at barriers, what psychology calls barriers to treatment. And the two that I've really focused on are shame and stigma. Guy, I wanted to share with you that how I opened into this conversation this morning is I'm interested in creating a dialogue about the phenomenology, into the phenomenology of addiction. And all of us are in recovery here, so we know about that firsthand, as well as what we've studied and read and come to know by talking to others. I'd really like to find a link between the phenomenology, the inner experience of addiction, and linking it to so-called left brain information. And today what I'm interested in doing is looking at two left-hand quadrants, the upper left, which looks at the individual's phenomenology, and the lower left, which looks at more collective or cultural phenomenology, worldview. I'm interested in looking at those and how those are informed or impacted by the right-hand quadrants, and specifically today I'm interested in looking at the upper right-hand quadrant, and to be more focused, I'm interested in looking at addiction in the brain, looking at the neuroscience of addiction. Are we all okay?
Yeah, someone didn't have their mic off.
Okay, it was like a waterfall or something. So what I'm interested in doing is talking for a few minutes about the phenomenology of these barriers to treatment, namely shame and stigma, and then I want to provide at least an introduction today, and we can revisit this over time, an introduction of how useful it can be, I believe, both personally and clinically, to draw on the right-hand or objective or empirical quadrants to inform the phenomenological. So that's part of what I'm interested in doing. And Guy, I'm particularly interested in light of both of what you've presented here to all of us, but also our ongoing conversation. I'm very interested, and I'll share personally and professionally how it's gone for me in terms of trying to bring these all together. Before we proceed, I'm talking about two barriers to treatment. The first one is shame, is that addicted individuals are oftentimes sunk by feelings of shame, and from all the readings I've done and some writing, Guy, are you there?
I'm still here.
Okay, we just... Between you and me, this drives me fucking crazy, Guy.
Yeah.
Eddie, are you back again?
We're back.
Okay, and Hamlet's on his way back. I just want to give Hamlet just another second here. I see his smiling face. It just isn't connected yet.
Okay.
I give it 15 more seconds here.
Okay.
I think we'll go ahead and proceed, and I'll keep my eye on Hamlet. I hope that he's able to rejoin us. I've got him trying to ring him in right now. Let me try one more time here. Let's see. Here we go. Okay. All right. I'm going to continue. Is that to the extent that individuals who are in addiction are dealing with shame, that it's next to impossible to take full responsibility or move forward or even choose psychologically when one is buried by shame.
Sure.
I went to a presentation on Friday. It was on the interpersonal neurobiology of addiction. It was actually at Cal Southern, Guy, the university where we both are at this point. And there were a few points here and there that he talked about, and I want to share one of them with all of us. I always want to check out things. I'm kind of a skeptic until I find more information, but he was citing two interpersonal neurobiologists in Los Angeles area, Daniel Siegel and Alan Shore, both affiliated with UCLA, and was talking about how it is that, this is the first time I've read this, and maybe you guys are familiar with it, but that the experience of shame actually promotes neural pruning, particularly of the dopamine receptors. And so prolonged exposure to shame ends up basically shearing off dopamine receptors in the brain, which would be, of course, implicated in the addiction process. Have any of you come across that before? That was the first time I'd heard somebody speak to that point. Hello?
Yeah, we are.
Okay. Okay. All righty. Let's try it as we are right now. Did you all hear the last point about neural pruning and shame?
No.
Yeah.
I went to a presentation this last Friday, Eddie, Derek, and Hamlet, and the presenter was presenting on the neurobiology of addiction, specifically the interpersonal neurobiology, and he was talking about research that has discovered that prolonged exposure to the experience of shame actually ends up leading to the neural pruning the diminishing of dopamine receptors in the brain, which would be directly implicated, was his point, would be directly implicated in the addiction process, insofar as I've been exposed to psychological shame, my brain is going to have less access to dopamine endogenously, and so I'm going to have to bring it in exogenously from the outside. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I'd never come across that before, and I want to do more reading. Apparently, it's Alan Shore who's done the writing about this. He's one of the local pioneers in this whole area, so I'm going to look into that. But let me ask you guys, what is shame? How do you guys think of shame?
I think of shame is it's self-created and constructed from an experience on the... Nobody can cause me to feel shame. If I do take it on, you know, I feel that I'm wrong or bad in some regard. And as a kid, you know, I believe a lot of this is childhood stuff being played out in 30, 40, 50, and 60-year-old bodies. And it's, you know, there's a lot of shame growing up. Even I think people have a challenging time asking for help and support in any regard. You go in third grade, if you ask what's 2 times 3, and everybody says, oh, you're stupid, you don't know that. I mean, that you learn to feel shame in that regard and ask for help and support. So I think that helps cultivate people using drugs and alcohol to change their mood of mind as a coping mechanism.
Yes. Very good. Thanks, Eddie. Thank you. I agree with all that you just said. Hamlet, how about you? When you think of shame, what comes to your mind?
That's a great question. I know what shame feels like physically. I was trying to come up with words to articulate it. I haven't done so yet. The only thing that comes to mind is the that unshakable, piercing, almost belly aching lack of belief in oneself, yeah, rooted with unrelatedness and uncertainty.
Yeah.
But that's a really good question. I'm like, wow, what is shame? Like, I know what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
Can I describe it?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
I know it has been a central feeling to my life, yeah, you know, was for, and sometimes still is, I mean, for many, many, many years, you know, shame and guilt and insecurity and fear and,
yeah,
all those ugly demons. It's a great question.
Well,
I don't know that I can answer it any better. I mean,
I think you answered it beautifully in terms of just getting at the felt sense or experience of shame. It makes me think there's, some of you may have read this book. There's a book by Yuk Pongsep, who's a Canadian neuroscientist, and it's just called Affective Neuroscience, and it sits on my bookshelf. I haven't read it yet, but I'm very interested in reading into what goes on in the body for us to feel the feelings you just described.
Yeah.
You know, I know emotionally and physically what it feels like, just like you just described, but I'm very curious, like this presentation on Friday that talked about shame in relationship to our dopamine circuitry, and specifically that it actually ends up eliminating dopamine neurons. That's radical shit to me. I mean, it's just... I'm really curious. I know what the feeling is like, and I know when I'm feeling it in a shame spiral, let's say, but I'm really curious about what's going on and what it serves evolutionarily. Guy, do you have some contribution here? I know you've thought about this a lot.
Yeah. Well, I think for me, it's also important to make a differentiation between healthy shame and unhealthy shame.
Yes,
shame itself is not a bad thing. I think it's like narcissism. It's not a bad thing. Unhealthy narcissism is a bad thing. And John Bradshaw makes a distinction between that, which I think is quite important. In the same way like cholesterol, you get healthy cholesterol and unhealthy cholesterol. So healthy shame is necessary because that's necessary to prune the rampant narcissism of a child. So if there's an healthy shame, you're just going to end up with a narcissist personality disorder, you know.
Yes.
But ironically, if there's too much shame, you can also end up with a narcissist personality disorder.
Yes.
But I think, you know, I mean, I certainly agree with Bradshaw that shame is one of the core and consistent elements that pretty much any addict will have in his, you know, sort of etiology of his addiction. And obviously, the more you use, the more that affects your shame. And I think for me, shame simply is a pervasive feeling, very often unarticulated, but a pervasive feeling that there's something wrong with you.
Yes.
That you don't quite measure up to what would be considered normal in society. I always use the analogy of that, like a scene in a factory where these people stand with these white little caps and they sort out rotten apples on a conveyor belt, you know, and then they sort of check, oh, there's one. And I think shame-based people feel like, you know, they're all coming down a conveyor belt and sooner or later they're going to be picked up and thrown in the basket at the back because they're going to be found to be sort of congenitally and fundamentally defective.
Yeah, that's a great image.
They can't quite articulate what that defect is. And I think it's very much pre-verbal. You can't quite say what's wrong with you, mm-hmm. but there's somehow feeling that there's something wrong with you.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a when you mentioned the pre-verbal, you reminded me there was a colleague of mine, a mentor out of Zurich, Switzerland. He was the president of the International Association of Jungian Analysts for years. His name was Mario Jacobi, and one of his earlier books was called Shame and the Origins of Self-Esteem. And in that book, he looked at the pre-verbal roots of self-esteem and how shame manifests from the earliest age in terms of to the extent that we're accurately mirrored and responded to, attuned to, and so on. And he drew on the work of the American developmental psychologist Daniel Stern. I'll mention that. I'll write this book down in just a minute. But it fits with what you were saying earlier, Hamlet, is that there's this kind of nameless sinking dread or self-annihilation, the feelings that go with shame that silence us and isolate us, and that, as you're saying, Guy, that they're oftentimes pre-verbal. You don't know what came over you, but you know that you're not the same, and you know that you're going to be picked off the conveyor belt at any moment or whatever, and it has that pre-verbal sense. Listen, you guys, I have a story I read just last week, and I want to share it with you. It's just a quote from the story. Are you all familiar with the story, The Little Prince, by Saint-Exupéry? He's a French author. I read this my first year in college, and I haven't read it since. And it's a fairy tale, I guess you'd say, for adults. But I found this quote out of The Little Prince, and I'll just share it with you. It's just a paragraph long, and it gets at one element of this quality of what we're talking about. Guy, your differentiation between healthy and toxic shame, I think, is really helpful following Bradshaw. Here's what The Little Prince says. Why are you drinking? The little prince asked. In order to forget, replied the drunkard. To forget what? Inquired the little prince, who was already feeling sorry for him. To forget that I am ashamed, the drunkard confessed, hanging his head. Ashamed of what? Asked the little prince, who wanted to help him. Ashamed of drinking, concluded the drunkard, withdrawing into total silence. And the little prince went away, puzzled. Grown-ups really are very, very odd, he said to himself as he continued his journey. That's it.
Yeah.
What I was struck by in this were a couple of things. One is the idea of being ashamed of drinking, that the cycle of being ashamed of one's drinking, one's addiction, itself perpetuates the cycle because of this experience we're describing. And then secondly is that, though it's not a focus of this little section, that it describes a couple of aspects of the phenomenology of shame, namely he's hanging his head and that he's withdrawing into total silence. That matches for sure my experience of shame. It separates us both from others and also from ourselves. What do you all think?
Yeah, I think as far as I'm concerned, shame is a secondary phenomenon. Shame is the effect of something even more primal. But I think the problem with shame is exactly what you're saying there, Bob. I think that's the problem with it, is that it prevents you from authentically showing yourself to other people. And that's the feeling of isolation. That's the effect of shame. and the fact that you can never really have your needs met because you never show your needs because you think your needs are unworthy to present to other people. And I think that's the problem with shame. And shame in itself, I don't think, is a problem. Well, it is. But the problem is that it dislocates you from people in your life. And that's what's, I think, leads to addiction. If, you know, if you can't have your needs met through other people or anything anymore, you're going to have to look for other ways to have it.
Yeah. Well said, Guy. You remind me of the feeling of this presentation on Friday I went to. It was by an American social worker, John Daly. And I think he had the same thesis, is that why he's talking about interpersonal neurobiology of addiction is that there's a physiological, from his perspective, there's a physiological base of what it is that we're experiencing inside, and its roots are in the interpersonal relationships. In other words, he's tying into attachment theory, into early object relations, and so on. The fact if there aren't strands of connectedness laid down by virtue of parental attunement, let's say, that I'm left however many more times vulnerable to seeking some other way of self-soothing, just as one example. And what better way to do that than through substance or other addictive behaviors?
And I think one of the problems that the people have that focus a lot on the neuroscience of addiction, which I think is certainly an important aspect of it, is also the idea that addiction is a brain disease. But there's quite a dramatic shift in people's brain structure after using a long time and beforehand. And as far as I'm concerned, any form of neuroscience explanation that of addiction before people use are pretty much on shaky ground, because I think there's a huge amount of people with people have had dysfunctional brain chemistry since the dawn of time.
Yes,
because until 100 years ago, most people pretty much lived on bread or gruel or maize or something, which I'm sure that didn't lead to healthy dopamine levels either. So I think human raised brains have always been non-optimal. But what is certainly clear is that once people become addicted, I think that's where the neuroscience becomes actually, as far as I'm concerned, only really relevant. Because then it clearly has a profound effect on the brain. And the other thing as well is, once people arrive into treatment and their needs are being met, then cravings also decrease and the capacity to actually stay clean. It's amazing that before people come to rehab, they can't stay clean a day. You put them in a treatment center, all of a sudden they can actually stay clean. And the only reason they can stay clean is because they're in a supportive environment. So what's strange to me is that, how does the brain, although the brain is still dysfunctional, and the limbic system seemingly doesn't have such a profound effect then on the rest of the brain once they're actually in a supportive environment, which actually in a way lowers the case that addiction is primarily a brain disease. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. It makes me think of how it is that, particularly from an interpersonal perspective, looking at neurobiology, the focus is less and less on the individual's brain than in the fact that we co-regulate one another, that my brain's integrity is upheld and actually developed in sync with your brain, if we're looking at just from the level of brain. And so the research that's being done at centers like at Harvard and UCLA right now, where they're hooking up couples or you know, dyads to brain scans to see how it is that the way that you and I are interacting right now is significantly informing my brain's function. And if we stay in interaction long enough, let's say like in a rehab situation, that being in your presence will help stabilize my brain and will not only affect it in terms of its functions, but over time can affect it in terms of my actual brain structure, that you'll get, you know, thickening of the frontal cortex, just as one example. And it's pretty crazy to think about this, that, you know, the Buddhists and other spiritualists have seen this for time immemorial, how it is that we, as the Vietnamese Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh says, it's not that we are, we inter are. The idea of interpenetration, and now brain scans are giving another vantage point on what it means to really be, how it is that we're all interpenetrating one another's beings constantly, that we're not really separate like we would think we are.
Absolutely. Well, that's why my my alternative definition for a sponsor is a rented frontal cortex.
I think that's brilliant.
So it's, instead of using my frontal cortex for a while, which has all been screwed up by drugs, you know, I use your frontal cortex until mine starts working.
Yeah, that's perfect.
That's good.
That's very perfect. You know, it's what psychoanalysts have called over the years, and you'll know this, Guy, and maybe the others will know this too. They talk about the auxiliary ego function supplied by the therapist, is that you've got an auxiliary ego, you've got a rented frontal cortex, and until you internalize that, it's very useful to have a sponsor or an effective psychotherapist. And I think there's good argument for that in rehab situations as well. You've got a whole bunch of rented frontal cortexes, cortices running around.
Yeah. Is that why people report, you know, feeling so good, let's say when they go to church, for example, or when they're in the presence of certain people? Are we talking about the same thing?
I think so. I think so. It's what Freud called a transference cure at its worst. It's the idea that Hamlet, insofar as you and I are in relation, let's say that you're my therapist or my coach or my minister, insofar as I'm in your presence, you're helping to co-regulate my own interior world. And so it's not to put it down to call it a transference cure, or it's what they call in the Buddhist tradition transmission of mind. I mean, there's different analogies, that these aren't perfect analogies, but the idea that being in the presence of a master, whether it's a good psychotherapist or a spiritual guru or whatever, has direct, powerful impact on our psyches and even our biologies. And so going to church or going to meetings where people go daily to 12-step meetings, I'm assuming that part of that is this process of co-regulation.
Go
ahead, Guy. Finish.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, that's certainly my understanding of AA or a meeting. You know, mm-hmm. the phenomenology of a meeting and the relationship that has with the individual's interior is, you know, let's look at it from a psychoanalytic perspective, is that the meeting itself and the institution of AA functions like a mother, like a good enough mother, mm-hmm. that can mirror you back and tell you that you're good enough. You know, I mean, that's why the entrance AA is to be a complete fuck up and being a drunk. You know, that's keeping the entrance bar pretty low. You know, it's just like, we accept you as long as you drink enough and you screw up, you're welcome here. So, I mean, you don't get more mothering than that.
Yeah.
And you can project, you know, these transference needs onto something that pretty much will never let you down. You know, that's why the policy, our doors always open, has got a profound psychoanalytic meaning. It basically says to you, listen, whenever you're ready, I'm here. It doesn't matter what you do. You can scrub as much as you like. Whenever you want to come back, I'm always here, you know, which is there's very few organizations that can offer that.
Yeah.
And then the idealized part is where you idealize the process, you know, you idealize your therapist or your sponsor and all that. And within those two sort of transferences, you have these basic narcissistic needs met, which I believe lies at the root. That's why I was saying shame is a secondary disorder. You know, the primary disorder is what I would refer to as, or these guys refer to as, okay, agnosticism, is not having your needs met. And when your needs aren't met, the way that you experience it phonemologically is shame. You experience, well, yeah. You know, the reason they didn't give me what I need is because I'm not good enough. Otherwise, I would have got that. So that the shame is the secondary thing. So the only way that that shame can be transmuted is in a similar, nearly primitive relationship where you need the strong transference, both of these strong types of transference. And that's why AA works so well when people actually use it.
I'm writing notes as you're talking. Somebody needs to talk. I'm going to write this down. It's great what you're saying, Guy. I'm going to send this out in just a second. Eddie, Derek, can we hear from you guys?
Yeah, no, it's all ringing very true, and it makes a lot of sense. It reminds me of the Buddhist concept of Sangha,
yes,
right?
It's
one of the three jewels. It's necessary for evolution to have that group around. I'm fascinated that it actually affects the brain structures as well, and it more evidence that these quadrants, you know, tetra arise, as they say,
yes,
right? It's not one
or
the other. It's that they all arise in communion with each other, and yeah, I was going to say earlier, my feeling about shame is that it's a sort of embarrassing inadequacy is how it always affects me.
Mm-hmm. That's a great, very concise definition. Embarrassing inadequacy. Mm. Yeah, there's something inadequate about my personality. There's a distinction made in attribution theory and psychology between what they call a situational attribution, where you blame your inadequacy on the situation. It was too much for me, or it was a wrong circumstance for me to be in. On the one hand, that's a situation. On the other hand is what they call a dispositional attribution, which is I blame it on something about me. There's something wrong about me that I can't golf any better than I can, or that I can't do this or that. And it's the second attribution, the dispositional attribution, where there's something wrong with me that's linked, for example, to the experience of depression. And I would say also to shame is when it shifts from a situational, like there's something about my circumstance, to there's something about me, that's the shift to this, what'd you call it, the feeling of embarrassing inadequacy?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Eddie, how about you? Any thoughts here?
Thank you for asking. Yeah, I'm happy to and glad that the conversation's flowing and going on shame and guilt and where it's at. I don't believe that shame and guilt, initially when we talked about, prevents people from getting into recovery and treatment nearly as much as we all talk about, or I think that does occur. Like, it's, you know, it's really not cool to go out and say you're a drug addict or alcoholic, I believe if somehow we could just tell everyone, you know, come here free of charge and you're going to get help on your, you know, if you want to say problem, brokenness, your affliction, addiction, habit, don't worry. The doors aren't going to be flooding and bombing off the hinges. You know, I understand there's wait lists. A lot of that is people are required to go there from jails and institutions and that. This is a challenge that society, I believe, people want to change their mood and mind, and it's a coping situation, and it's like, how do the trade-off or selling point isn't, you give me a drug or a behavior that's going to act, I know what it does, it's been working for me, so to speak, it does have some challenges and problems at times, I get in trouble at times, but that's a guarantee, and I'm psychologically, physically addicted to behavior or a substance, and then give me a slow road to China, AA or something, meditate. That's where it's really interesting, how to create a community, sangha, or environment that will help and support people on that journey. And AA says, you know, the only requirement is a desire to keep drinking, you know, to stop drinking. Like, I like how Guy, you know, described all that. We can be all messed up and then it will always have its doors open. The one favorable aspect is if you have a desire to stop drinking and are willing to go to any lengths and thoroughly convinced, then there's that opportunity. But I think shame and guilt in this substance abuse and addiction is a lot more the cause of people, you know, using and getting addicted, and not nearly as much as preventing people from going and getting help. When your ass is on fire, you know, you don't care who the fireman is. Just get my ass off the fire. If you're drinking and drugging and you think you have a problem, you're going to go for it regardless of the stigma. In my opinion, it's not nearly as a big deal as people make it. I think it's an excuse and it's addictive thinking, more so just keeping us in it.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Eddie. I appreciate that. What you bring up, we're going to have to wind down in just a minute, but what you bring up, I think, is what I'd like to follow up on. If maybe we can do this next week. We'll sort this out, Guy, and with John, would be to follow up to talk some more into the kind of the lower left-hand quadrant. We've been talking primarily about shame today. And I'd like to look also at cultural stigma. And I've got some information there, just some statistics that have been gathered. I'll share one as we close, just to kind of plant a seed, and let's follow up on this. And I think this can be a conversation kind of in progress, because I would like to bring in some insights from neuroscience that have to do specifically with what we're talking about in terms of shame and stigma. I think it's good. It feels like we're laying a foundation for kind of the phenomenology that I'm going to argue could be informed by better information, scientific information. Here's a statistic. Eddie, I'm going to share this with you, but in response to what you just said, but for all of us, I want to track this down. I was actually looking through my notes. I found it in the last couple of weeks, is that a recent study of in the U.S. is that 2/3 of families are directly touched by addiction. 2/3. 2 out of 3 family members have somebody that's addicted. And I want to find out more specifically what that means. But if I can just use that as a basic kind of first run through, 2/3 of families are touched directly by addiction. I want to find out what the definition of family is. But 2/3 of families are touched by addiction. You go back and you give a second question, which is ask those same people about stigma. That is stigmatizing attitudes. And we'll go more into detail about this maybe next week. Is that 2/3 of those same people say that there's a severe enough cultural stigma about addiction that they don't speak about it with anybody outside the family. And so you got 2/3 of families touched by addiction, 2/3 of people that are responding to the same interview questions say that there's such severe stigma that they don't dare talk about it outside the family. And so what it leads me to inquire further into, and we can do this together, is that I agree with you, I think, Eddie, in principle, is that if somebody has the fire lit strong enough, they're going to seek treatment no matter what. But I think what's suggested by the statistics like this is that because of the potential of stigma shutting down people reaching out, seeking help, is that it probably wait far longer to reach out than otherwise would be the case. And so I just want to plant that seed is, what's the impact of kind of unquestioned stigmatizing attitudes in the culture on people actually getting into treatment earlier or younger? And I don't have an answer to that so much as I just want to talk about it. Does that seem fair game, you guys, if we stop here and pick up next week?
Sure.
Yep, sounds good. Yeah.
It's been great dialoguing. Thank all of you for joining us. And I think next Tuesday we'll have John back with us, hopefully. And Guy, you and I'll be back on Thursday morning, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Thursday evening, your time. So we'll see all you guys at, I guess it's, never is it 11 o'clock Mountain Standard Time on Thursday?
That's right.
Okay, all righty. Right. Be well, and we'll be in touch, and we'll see each other on Thursday.
All right, guys.
Bye-bye for now. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Thanks, guys.